mistake. We thought there'd be a recession sooner. That's a fact. We did think there'd be a recession sooner. And there should have been a recession sooner. But the bourgeois were so afraid of the effects of a recession, they were afraid of the political and social effects of a recession, that they used these methods to avoid a recession. For example, the rate of interest was held down at a very low level. Over 10 years ago, serious bourgeois economists like Stephen Rhodes was warning them. Stephen Rhodes warned the Federal Reserve, for goodness sake, you must raise the rate of interest. If they had done that 10 years ago, there would have been a recession, of course. But it would have prevented the crazy housing boom, the speculative boom that took place subsequently. They'd have prevented that lunacy in America, in Spain, in Ireland, and so on. You know, it's a comical thing when you read the bourgeois economists. Don't forget to pass me a note. They always sing the same song. Ah, we've learned our lessons. We've learned the lessons of history. And therefore, there will not be another 1929, they said. Learned the lessons. And Hegel answered that quite neatly in his Introduction to the Philosophy of History. He said, anyone that looks at history can only come to one conclusion. That nobody has ever learned anything from history. History constantly repeats itself. It's the same story in every boom in history. During a boom, the productive forces increase. More surplus value is extracted from the workers. Huge profits are made. There's a boom on the stock exchange. The banks are very eager to lend. They lend anybody anything. There's an expansion of credit. And let's be clear what credit is. The bourgeois economists say, oh, this is a credit crunch. It's a crisis of credit. They never say what credit is. Marx answered that a long time ago. And if you think about it, it's perfectly logical. All that credit is a means whereby the capitalists artificially expand the market beyond its normal limits. With these little bits of plastic. It's a marvelous thing, credit. You know, you can buy a car and a house and holidays in the Bermudas and all kinds of things. There's only one small little problem with these bits of plastic. Sooner or later, you must pay this money back. With interest. And therefore, all that credit can do is temporarily avoid a crisis of overproduction. At the cost of enormously exacerbating the next crisis when it comes. That's precisely what's happened. Of course, during a boom, it's like a big party. At the end of the Congress, we'll have a party. And no doubt one or two comrades will have a drink. And one or two might drink a little bit too much. And there's always somebody in a party that will come up and tap him on the shoulder. A good friend will tap him on the shoulder. You know, I really think that you've had enough today. I think you should stop. You'll be sorry in the morning, you know. And what does the drunk reply to this? Leave me alone. Or words to that effect. I don't know if you could translate that adequately. Of course, the next day he's got a terrible headache. And he says, never again. Yes, until the next party. Am I right or am I right? But that's the same with the boozma. Oh, we've learned the lesson. They learn nothing. And they plunged into a speculative orgy. The banks would lend money to anybody. They lent billions in America to poor people to buy their homes when they knew perfectly well they didn't have money to pay these loans. And they actually sold this debt on the stock exchange. I don't know how you can do that, but they did it anyway. They sold the debts. And respectable banks were buying this debt. In Iceland, for example, they bought it. They lent money to Greece. German banks and French banks in particular lent a lot of money to Greece. And it was perfectly clear that the Greeks were not going to be able to repay this money. It was a joke. But as long as everything was going forward, everyone was making money, they said, well, who cares? Yes, now all of those factors are turning into the opposite. Dialectically, this process reached a critical point in which the whole thing started to collapse, starting in the United States with the subprime crisis. And now, dialectically, everything turns into its opposite. The very factors that pushed the economy up in an upward spiral are now combining to drive the whole economy down in a downward spiral. Which they cannot control. They can't stop it, they can't control it. They've tried. For example, they've given all this money to the banks. The bourgeois economists say this is a crisis of liquidity. There's not enough money. Therefore, it's the cause of the crisis, they say, is a lack of money. And Marx answered this in advance. He explained, it's not the lack of money that causes a crisis, it's the crisis that causes a lack of money. And now you see that all these attempts have failed. And you can see the panic of the bourgeois by the crisis in Greece. Now, Greece is a small, weak, peripheral capitalist economy on the periphery of Europe. You must ask yourself the question, how is it possible that a crisis in this tiny peripheral country can cause such a catastrophe on world markets? You can see the extreme nervousness of the bourgeois reflected in the movements on the stock exchange. At the beginning of this year, there were steep falls on the stock exchanges, not just in Europe, but in the United States, and also in Asia. And yet, if you look at it, Greece, Portugal, Spain, and even Italy, if you include Italy, it's only about 4% of total world economic activity. That's all. But the crisis of the euro immediately becomes a world crisis. They're all terrified. And what's the reason for that? We've explained in advance that globalization manifests itself as a global crisis of capitalism. The world economy now is linked together, it's so knitted together, that any crisis in one sector must affect the rest. In Europe, the crisis in Greece has had a domino effect. It's dragged down Spain, it's dragged down Portugal, tomorrow it'll drag down Italy, and Britain is not far behind. Actually, politics has got a certain comic aspect. If you have a warped sense of humor, it can be quite funny, you know. The Greeks, who by the way, they falsified the figures. They falsified the figures. You know. It's an old Greek tip. It comes from the old days, you know. The Greeks are very fond of haggling, you know. They're a bit like the Turks in that. They like haggling, you know. They just told lies. They told blatant lies. Yes, but the Germans knew they were lying, for goodness sake. Everybody knew they were lying. And the fact of the matter is this. I'll make a prediction now. The European bourgeois is putting excruciating pressure on the Greek government to cut and cut and cut to solve this problem of the deficit. From a capitalist point of view, they have no alternative. From a capitalist point of view, they have no alternative. They must cut. And the immediate effect of that is to cause an explosion of the class struggle in Greece. Immediately. And that shows the future of every country in Europe in a mirror. You think that the Greek workers or the Spanish workers or the Italian workers are just going to sit back and smile and fold their arms while their living standards are destroyed? If you think that, comrade, you've got another thing coming. The Greek workers immediately came onto the streets. And there's been 7 general strikes in Greece so far this year, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's 7. Epta, that's it. Yes. 7, and there'll be more. You know, and that shows what will happen in every other country in Europe. But the ruling class has got no alternative but to continue. And they will continue. But I'll make a prediction for Greece. They will carry out all these cuts in spite of the general strikes. They will carry out the cuts. And at the end of the day, the Greek economy is going to collapse. Because by carrying out cuts, you are reducing demand. And the only possible result of that is a deep slump in Greece, which has already begun. And paradoxically, the Greeks will not be able to pay the money that's been. They will never pay that money back. Never. Now, I said it's got its comical side. The German capitalist class were the ones that were pushing for European unity. They had big ideas that Germany was going to dominate Europe, particularly under Kohl. They moved the capital to Berlin. They were going to dominate both Eastern Europe and Western Europe and the Balkans and Greece. That was the theory. And they actually benefited in the sort. They don't say that now, but they benefited quite a lot from the single currency. It's a bit like the gangster film. You know the old gangster films about Chicago? As long as there's plenty of loot, then the gangsters, the different mafia gangs, can do a deal, a gentleman's agreement. You take this territory, I'll take that territory. And we're all good friends. Yes, but when there's not enough loot, then the fighting begins. Europe is in crisis. Mass unemployment. The bourgeois are not making profits. There are huge debts which can't be paid. And Greece, what is Greece? Greece is it's the sickest man of several sick men which are in Europe. Spanish capitalism is sick. Portuguese capitalism is sick. And the truth of the matter is, Italian capitalism is very sick. And Britain is not far behind. They think they're clever, the British, you know. They're having a good laugh. That's why nobody likes the Brits, you know, in Europe. Nobody likes the Brits. They consider themselves superior. Ah, you see, we're not in the euro. We're not in the euro. We're all right. We're not in the euro. We shall see. This is going to have a domino's effect. And the British economy is in a very weak position. And the truth of the matter is, American capitalism is also sick if you look at the figures. Now, what does it mean? What does this mean? The Economist, which is a serious British bourgeois journal, in an editorial at the beginning of this year, made an interesting comment. It said, from an historical point of view, the year 2008 will be remembered as the years in which the big banks collapsed, defaulted. But history will record the year 2010 as the year in which states defaulted, states collapsed. It's a fact. It's already happened in one case, which is a peripheral economy, but it's true. But Iceland had that position. Iceland defaulted. And that can happen in other countries and will happen in other countries. No matter what they do, Greece is going to default. And probably it'll be pushed out of the euro, quite likely. But that will open up a social and political crisis in Greece which has never been seen since the 1930s. Since the 1940s, I stand corrected. It will be like Germany in 1923. You think you have a crisis in Greece? The crisis in Greece has not begun yet. And this is a terrifying prospect for European capitalism. And of course, this nice President of Germany, Angela Merkel, this nice democratic woman, turns around and says, well, it's very bad. Why should the German people pay for these lazy Greek workers? It's not fair. It's not fair. Why should we put our hands in our pockets to help the Greeks? Which, of course, is nonsense. And in the end, they gave the money, or loaned the money, actually. They created a fund of 1 trillion euros, almost 1 trillion euros. Why this generosity? Why this so generous? Is it to help the people of Greece? That's not the reason. You must ask yourself the question. Who loaned the money to Greece? And the answer is German banks and French banks. And therefore, if they didn't help the Greeks somehow, the German banking system would collapse. It's a fact. Yes, but what have they solved? What have they solved? They've solved nothing. They've only gained a little bit of time. The Greek economy is going to collapse. Nothing can save it. They cannot return this money. And that will have a profound effect on the rest of Europe, including Germany. And therefore, you see that the future for European capitalism is not particularly rosy. It's a future of extreme instability. And if you think about it calmly for a moment, it's perfectly clear. All that they've done in the last 2 years is to pour money into the banks, which comes from the state. So all that they have done is to transfer the huge debts of the banks so that they become huge debts of the public sector, of the state. I'll give you one astonishing example. A country we don't usually talk about. In 1990, 10 years ago, was it 20 years ago, the public debt of Japan was 65% of the gross domestic product. That's a lot. You know how much it is now? Almost 200% of the gross domestic product of Japan is debt, public debt. And this is unsustainable. The whole situation is unsustainable. Now, you see, we must pose the question in fundamental terms. How is it that the capitalists managed to avoid a slump for 2 decades? How is it? How did they manage that? In order to answer that question, you have to ask yourself another question. What is the fundamental cause of capitalist crisis? It's not a crisis of credit or liquidity. That's false. And we must always remind ourselves that there are two fundamental barriers which are blocking the progress of humanity. First, private ownership of the means of production and the anarchy of the market which flows from that. And second, the nation state, which has become translated into an enormous barrier. But for a whole period, the capitalists succeeded in partially overcoming these obstacles. Partially. They can't have completely solved this. It's partial. And temporary. First of all, as I said, by an enormous increase in credit. But that's now reached its limits. They can't expand credit any further. On the contrary, they have to pay the debts back. To give you a precise idea of the level of debt, during the boom, in the United States, for every dollar that was earned, $1.4 was debt. It was owed. In Britain, the situation was even worse. For every pound that was owed, that was earned, £1.6 was owed. Now that's collapsed. And that's the main reason why the crisis is so severe. The second obstacle is the nation state, the narrow limits of the nation state, national market, which is too narrow to contain the colossal growth of the productive forces. And they partly overcame that through globalization. It's true. Lowering tariff barriers. And enormously increasing what the Marxists called the international division of labor. And in the short run, that assisted them. In the short run, that was assisted them. In the short run, that assisted them. If you, particularly since the collapse of the Soviet Union, which meant that Russia, Eastern Europe, and China, for the first time, were incorporated into the capitalist world economy. And India, which is a different case, of course. But also, it was only partly involved previously. Now it's completely involved. So for the first time in history, the entire population of the world is participating fully in the world capitalist economy. Probably 2 billion people began to participate who were not participating before. You take China, for example, where millions of Chinese peasants have flocked to the towns. And the American and European and Japanese capitalists have invested heavily in China. With the most modern factories. The most modern technology. And virtual slave labor. Workers working for very small wages. In conditions like the conditions in the times of Charles Dickens and Karl Marx. Which of course, but there's just one little problem. Of course that produced huge profits, naturally. There's just one small little problem with this. Which I had to point out 20 years to some comrades who were a bit blinded by the question of China. Sooner or later, these factories in China will begin to produce commodities. Which must be sold. In order to realize surplus value, you've got to sell the goods. Now, there is an important internal market in China, it is true. But it's not a market of 1.3 billion people, as they say. Because the big majority of the population in China are peasants living in extremely low conditions. The real market in China is probably about 300 million, which is quite a lot. Although it's still less than Europe, of course. But there's no way that the market in China can absorb the colossal amounts that are being produced. They have to be exported. And where are you going to export to? Previously, they exported to the United States, to Europe, to Japan. even to Brazil, Argentina, Mexico. Yes, but that's no longer possible to the same degree. The market in the United States is sharply reduced. The market in Europe is sharply reduced. There are higher levels of unemployment. And now the American senators and congressmen are raising shouts of pain. Protesting about all these cheap Chinese imports taking away American jobs. There are strong protectionist tendencies developing everywhere, and that will get worse, naturally. Let's be clear. Protectionism is an attempt to export unemployment to other countries. And therefore, what you must understand is this. Did globalization help capitalism? Yes, of course. Of course. Did it solve any of the fundamental contradictions of capitalism? It did not resolve a single one of those contradictions, but merely reproduces them on a vast scale. On a global scale. And that is what is really terrifying the bourgeois. They don't know what to expect. And this colossal instability now. They don't know how to get out of the crisis. And the only thing which occurs to them, they're all agreed on this, is that we must attack living standards. We can't afford reforms. We must cut wasteful state expenditure. You know, there's terrible waste. We all know this. Terrible wasteful expenditure. On unnecessary things like schools and hospitals and houses and things like this. And they've only just started this. The question of pensions, I've dealt with that before, so I won't repeat it. But the problem is this. This is undoubtedly the deepest crisis in history. And yet we are faced with a contradiction. Why is there not an immediate movement in the direction of revolution? Why are there not big strikes and workers taking to the streets in all countries? It is a contradiction, but it's a dialectical contradiction. It's a fact that the consciousness of the whole human race, if you like, is not a revolutionary factor, but it's a very conservative factor. In general, people don't like change. People will cling to the existing society, the existing laws, the existing states, the existing institutions. Until they're forced by events to abandon these ideas. But you see, the consciousness of the present generations in Europe is the product of the last 50 years. in which, in most countries anyway, things were not too bad. Even if you had to work a bit harder, extra hours and so on, and credit, get into debt. Even if your sons and daughters had to work on low wages and so on. But at the end of the day, the general income coming in wasn't too bad. You could buy things you couldn't buy in the past, like these big television screens and computers and I don't know what. Clever phones. These phones are marvelous, you know. I don't understand them myself, but they're marvelous things. I was in a car last night with Serge Goulart from Brazil. And he's got a phone that tells the car which way to go. You know, it's a navigator in his phone. Wonderful. He got us completely lost, but that's another matter. Made in China, I think. But in general, things were, even in Greece, things were not too bad. And therefore, the workers have still not understood the true seriousness of the crisis. And when the trade union leaders, the reformists, are anxious, they don't want to fight. And they're all singing the same song. Oh, it's very serious. We've got a serious crisis, serious problem here, you know. Have to solve it somehow, you know. So, you tighten your belt a little bit. And accept a few cuts. And all will be well. We will return to normality. That's what people think. Most people think that, still. But the answer to that was put very clearly by a journalist, an English journalist recently, an economist, who said the following. Yes, sooner or later we will return to normality. But it will be a new normality. It's finished. This nice situation you had for the last 50 years is finished. With reforms and hospitals and health and pensions, it is finished. What we are talking about here, let's be clear about this. What we're talking about is a long period of years or maybe decades of lowering of living standards, high unemployment, cuts and austerity. The problem is this. Over the last 50 years, the working class has emerged enormously strengthened. The organizations of the working class are intact. And I repeat, if anyone thinks that the workers of Greece, of Italy, of Spain, of Britain are going to accept the systematic destruction of what? Of the elements of a semi-civilized existence which they'd conquered since the Second World War. If you think that that's going to be occurred without an enormous succession of battles, then you're very much mistaken. Of although in the short term, it does not appear to be the case, with the exception of Greece. There are not many strikes. There have been some demonstrations. But so far the response seems to be very slow. I think that might produce a certain perplexity among some comrades, a certain impatience among some comrades. I think at bottom that was a large part of the problem we had with the comrades in Spain. Who had a completely mechanical, undialectical conception of how the class struggle will unfold. Now, the comrades should not be perplexed, and they should not be surprised, because we explained this situation more than even 20 years ago. You read the previous perspectives documents. Some comments go through them looking for mistakes. And they will find quite a few mistakes. Some mistakes, anyway, they will find. But I will say this. The fundamental lines of our perspectives have been absolutely correct and have been brilliantly confirmed by what's taking place now. I'll state that bluntly. And we explained that in the event of a deep crisis and the sudden onset of mass unemployment, the immediate effect would not be an intensification of the class struggle. The workers would be shocked, they'd be stunned, they'd be disoriented. And yes, I will predict that they will accept many impositions. Because nobody's offering any alternative. They will accept and accept and accept and accept until it reaches a critical point where they will say, that's enough. Enough is enough. No more. Not prepared to accept any more attacks. In other words, what we are saying is, this is a finished recipe for an outbreak of the class struggle in all countries in the next period. A finished recipe. Although it might take a little time to get underway. We must be patient with the working class. But they've got to learn from experience. It is a recipe for class struggle. And I will repeat a kind of equation which we put forward several years ago. All the attempts of the bourgeois to re-establish the economic equilibrium will destroy the political and social equilibrium. And by the way, just one other word on the economy. Marx explained many times that the fundamental cause of the real cause, well, let me quote the exact words, the final cause of all real capitalist crisis is overproduction. Let me give you a little quote, not from Marx, This is from a bourgeois economist. Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Sounds like a Welshman. Ambrose. There is one overwhelming fact. About the world economy that cannot be wished away, that cannot be ignored. Excess capacity in industry is hovering at levels not seen since the Great Depression. And just listen to this. Too many steel mills have been built. Too many plants making cars, computer chips, or solar panels. Too many ships, two houses. They have outstripped the spending power of those supposed to buy the products. This is more or less what happened in the 1920s when electrification and Ford's assembly line methods lifted output faster than wages. It is a key reason, why the slump proved so intractable. Though debt was far lower then than it is today. He says many other things, but I don't have time to deal with that. And of course, excess capacity is only another way of expressing overproduction. And the fact is, unless and until they've eliminated this colossal excess capacity and eliminated the debts, there is no real prospect of any genuine, lasting, solid economic recovery. None whatever. And therefore, what kind of a perspective are we looking at here? A perspective of years and possibly decades of enormous economic, political, and social instability. A period, as we said a long time ago, of wars, of revolutions, and of counter-revolutions. And you already see the symptoms of that, the first anticipations. Of course, in the weaker backward capitalist countries, there was an insurrection in Kyrgyzstan not long ago. It was an armed insurrection, which overthrew the government. It's true that that's since been deviated on the lines of sectarian violence and so on. That's true. That was deliberate. Because there's no leadership, no Bolshevik party. Let's be clear about this. If it had not been for the presence of the Bolshevik party in 1917, there was a revolution in February, but it wasn't finished. The workers were strong enough to overthrow the old regime, but they weren't strong enough to take power at that stage, or they didn't understand that they had to take power. If it had not been for the presence of the Bolshevik Party in Russia, what do you think would have happened? Because there were powerful counter-revolutionary forces at that time. Not just General Kornilov, but the fascist Black Hundreds were very strong, by the way. Vicious pogroms against the Jews and the Armenians. What you would have seen in Russia is exactly what you see now in Kyrgyzstan. Make no mistake about it. And then we'd have had the clever university professors writing in the history books. Of course, there was not really any revolution in Russia in 1917. The reaction was bound to win. And Lenin and Trotsky had a completely false perspective. You had the insurrection in Kyrgyzstan. You had a semi-insurrection in Bangkok, in Thailand. Which is a marvelous mass movement. But again, the same problem, no leadership. And temporarily, the movement in Thailand has been defeated, but it will come back. It will come back. And above all, in Iran, where there was a marvelous revolution taking place. Now, sometimes I don't understand people, really. Sometimes I scratch my head. Some people say, oh, there's no revolution in Iran. Where's the revolution in Iran? I think I'm getting a bit religious in my old age, The same phrase comes into my head all the time. God, give me strength. Oh, no revolution in Iran, eh? No revolution. After 30 years of the most ferocious dictatorship. Based on a regime of terror. You had an outburst. It was spontaneous. There was no leadership. Of millions of people, millions. And they say, oh, well, it wasn't a workers' movement, Millions of who are the millions of people on the streets of Tehran? I don't know. Were they all bourgeois or something? Or I don't know what they. A very courageous movement. And what surprised me was how long it lasted. With no leadership, no perspective. I predicted in the first article that I wrote that this movement is very heroic, but it cannot last. Because you can't call people onto the streets every day to get their heads cracked with no perspective. What was required was a general strike. And Soviets, because there's a tradition of Soviets in Iran. We saw that in 1979. There's a word for Soviets in Parsi, which is the Shuras. I think that's right, the Shuras. If they'd have had something like the Bolshevik Party 12 months ago in Iran, they could have overthrown the regime like that. But there was no such party. And unfortunately, the so-called vanguard played a shameful role. They didn't give leadership to that movement. But what surprised me was that it continued and continued and continued until the 26th of December, which is called Ashura. It's the most important event in the Shiite religious calendar. Again, the masses took to the streets. Again, the masses took to the streets. Fighting with the police and the revolutionary guards and so on. Oh, revolution? What revolution? Where's the revolution? You know what Lenin said about that? Whoever wishes to see a pure social revolution will never live to see one. Such a person pays lip service to revolution and they don't know what a revolution is. We should have a lengthy discussion on that. By the way, the Iranian group has done marvelous work in a short space of time. And our articles and our ideas have had a big impact inside Iran. Make no mistake about it. A big impact. The last article that I wrote on the anniversary has been reproduced in communist websites in Iran and other countries. But there's a very simple answer to all these gentlemen who deny that there's a revolution in Iran. Which Comrade Zordi pointed this out to me 1 week ago. There's the beginnings of splits in the so-called revolutionary guard, which is the counter-revolutionary guard. And there was a commander of the counter-revolutionary guard who gave a press conference. In which he pointed out that during the events of Ashura, they prepared a jet plane, an aeroplane, to fly Khamenei out of Iran to escape and the leaders of the government. So if that's not a revolution, I don't know what is. But in any case, what we said was that the Iranian revolution has begun. In the same sense that the February Revolution represented the beginning of the Russian Revolution. Or perhaps a better analogy would be 1931 represented the beginning of the Spanish Revolution. A revolution is not a one-act drama. It goes through all kinds of stages with the ebbs and flows, ups and downs, periods of advance, but also periods of defeat, tiredness, disillusionment, even reaction. The Spanish Revolution is a good example. You had a big upsurge in 1931 when the monarchy collapsed. But then you had a period of disillusionment and even black reaction for 2 years. The two black years, it's known in Spanish. But under the conditions in Spain, that was only a preparation for the new upsurge which led to the Popular Front and then the Civil War. You remember that even in 1917, there was a period of black reaction in July and August. Well, Lenin had to flee to Finland to escape. But that was only a preparation for a new period of upsurge which led to the October Revolution. And undoubtedly we'll see the same thing in Iran. And I will say a few words about the Middle East. Particularly because we have the presence here today, not just of the comrades from Iran, but the presence of the comrades from Iraq, which is obviously a very important country. And the Middle East is a very important area for us. And if you look at the invasion of Iraq, what did they solve? By the way, when we say it's a period of wars, revolution, and counter-revolution, there's a case in point. I sometimes think that George Bush has seen too many John Wayne films, you know. I don't know, perhaps the comrades are too young in the audience. Have you ever seen a John Wayne film? No? Yeah, you don't want to, really. You know, the 7th Cavalry fighting the Indians, you know. They thought they were just going to walk into Iraq, take over the country, set up a puppet government, of course, install democracy, and democracy under American control, that is. Then they would take the oil, of course, it's a small detail, and everything would be fine. Now, you remind yourselves that American imperialism is the most powerful military machine that's ever existed in the history of this planet. They have in their hands the most terrifying, sophisticated weapons of mass destruction. And the Iraqi army actually was virtually destroyed before they went into Iraq. When did they go into Iraq? I can't remember. It was 2003. And shortly afterwards, George Bush, who, by the way, is a coward who escaped from military service during the Vietnam War, appeared on an American warship dressed up as a soldier, and he uttered the famous words, "Mission accomplished." Well, 7 years have passed. Has the mission been accomplished? The fact of the matter is that they've been defeated. It's a defeat. This war in Iraq, they've been defeated by the heroic resistance of the Iraqi people. Thousands of American soldiers have been killed. And I don't know how many poor Iraqis have been killed. But also the war is costing American, the occupation of Iraq is costing them. If I remember correctly, John will correct me. $2 billion a week. You know, not even the richest power in the world. Can tolerate such a hemorrhage of blood and gold. It's not possible. And therefore, as soon as Obama came to power, he took one look at the position and he said, right, out, we're leaving. But of course, what will happen now in Iraq, that's another question. But there is a workers' movement in Iraq, and there's a tradition of socialism in Iraq. And we must discuss with the comrade ways and means of developing the work in that country. But the only thing which they've achieved, the American imperialists have behaved like an elephant in a china shop, not a bull in a china shop. Is to completely destabilize the Middle East. That's all they've achieved. Which is a key area for American imperialism. And there's a whole series of Arab bourgeois regimes which are hanging by a thread. Saudi Arabia is hanging from a thread. Egypt is hanging by a thread. Jordan and Morocco are hanging by a thread. And at any time you can see movements in these countries. There's been big strikes in Egypt, a country which has got perhaps the most powerful working class in the Middle East. And therefore, we must discuss the perspectives of the Middle East. But undoubtedly, a successful revolution in Iran would cut right across the whole position. We don't know exactly what kind of government would come to power. But there's one thing you can be sure of. It will not be based on Islamic fundamentalism. After 30 years of oppression, the people of Iran are up to here with the mullahs. And therefore that will have a fundamental effect everywhere. Now, if you take even the key country of imperialism, even in the United States, you see already the beginnings of a change. Even the election of Obama was a change. Don't forget that the United States was a country where nobody voted, people didn't vote. They say, what's the point? There's no difference. And there is no difference between the Republicans and the Democrats. No real difference, anyway. And yet you had the spectacle of large thousands of crowds of thousands of people queuing up. Waiting from the early hours of the morning to vote for Obama. And if you ask these people, why are you doing this? I'm sure the way that they were answer, how they would answer, because we are fed up with the old system. We want a change. There's a profound desire for change in the United States. Of course, with Obama, they don't get any change. He's a man with absolutely nothing to say, but he says it extremely well. It's completely empty. And therefore, there will be the beginnings of a change in the United States. Which is faced with insoluble contradictions. The U.S. budget deficit, the last estimate that I saw, would be in the region of $9 trillion for the next 10 years. That's excluding the states. Excluding the states. The states have got their own deficit, their own budget. How many people have lost their homes, John? Where's John? How many millions have lost their home? 2 million. At least 2 million people have lost their home. There are soup kitchens. There are tent cities, like the 1930s. And there's serious problems also at the level of states. For example, California. California, which is run by Governor Schwarzenegger. You've heard of Schwarzenegger. You know, the Terminator, you know. They've got higher unemployment now in California than the national average. Schwarzenegger is carrying out deep cuts in health, in education, in prisons, cárceles. He's even closing the parks. And this must have an effect. It means, in effect, the American dream is finished. Now, at this stage, you can't say that there's a dramatic change. But there is a ferment in America. And there's a questioning of the capitalist system which did not exist before. You know, when Lehman Brothers collapsed, the American communists showed a lot of initiative, you know. Typical Yankees, lots of initiative. And they went to sell our paper on Wall Street. That was very audacious. And people were buying the paper. And on the front page, the slogan was, if I'm not mistaken, capitalism has failed. and one smartly dressed gentleman bought the paper, looked at the cover, and said, "Ain't that the truth?" You see, even sections like that are being affected. The collapse for the support for Obama is collapsing, by the way. It was more than 60%, I think. And now it's less than 50%. 40%. And everywhere in all countries you see the same thing. There's a deep-seated sense of anger. Frustration. Rage. A deep sense of injustice, which is preparing the way for revolutionary developments in all countries at this or that different level or speed. The crisis of Europe is clear. The crisis of the euro reflects the sickness of European capitalism. And that must be reflected in an outburst of the class struggle in all countries. There's been big demonstrations in France, in Portugal, in Ireland, in Italy, in Spain. But of course, what's the problem? The problem is a problem of leadership, the leadership of the working class. Trotsky pointed out in 1938, in the transitional program, you can reduce the crisis of humanity into the crisis of leadership of the proletariat, of the organizations of the proletariat. It's an actual fact. Now, there's a very interesting article, one of the last things that Trotsky wrote, called Trade Unions in the Epoch of Imperialist Decay. Many comrades have read that and commented on it. And in this article, Trotsky explains that there's an organic tendency on the part of the trade union leaders to fuse with the capitalist state. And that, of course, is correct. You can see that tendency reiterated time and time again. But you must be careful, comrades, you know. Some comrades read Lenin and Trotsky sometimes in a very mechanical spirit. And they draw incorrect, fundamentally incorrect conclusions. At the present time, because the process which Trotsky referred to has got limits. In all countries, the trade union leaders are trying to reach a deal with the capitalists. They're desperate to avoid a struggle. They don't want to fight. You know what the trade union leaders want. They always want the same thing. Daniel is shaking, he's nodding his head before I say what it is. They want a peaceful life. They want a peaceful life. Unfortunately, the person that wants a peaceful life should have been born at a different period in history. There is no chance of a peaceful life for anybody. And in order to get what they want, to get a deal, which they can sell to their members, the trade union leaders must have something. The bourgeois must offer them something. But with these figures, with these deficits, the bourgeois have absolutely nothing to offer. Nothing. Except cuts and more cuts. And therefore, the trade union leaders will try to get an agreement, of course. But how can they get an agreement? No agreement is possible. And all the deals that they sign, it will break down. Everything, it will break down. And I'll predict now that even the most right-wing trade union leaders, under these circumstances, and under the pressure of the working class, will be forced into opposition. They'll be forced to lead general strikes and strikes, which they don't want to do, of course. Don't want to do. We already see that in Greece. And you'll see it in other countries also. You saw it in Italy. The leaders of the CGIL wanted to do a deal with the government, with Berlusconi. They were willing to do a deal. But it was not possible. And therefore, very reluctantly, they had to call a general strike. Although, of 4 hours, of course, 4 hours. Mustn't go too far, comrades, you know, 4 hours. You see the same thing in Spain. The trade union leaders of Spain were desperate to do a deal with the socialist government, the government of Zapatero. And Zapatero was desperate to do a deal with the trade union leaders. That is true. But no deal was possible. And therefore the trade union leaders have been forced to call a general strike in September. That shows the way that things are going to develop. The same thing will happen in Britain in the next period. But on this question of general strikes, we have to be a little bit careful. The former comrades in Spain had an entirely they had a fetish of the general strike. Every issue of the papers, general strike, general strike, general strike, general strike. You didn't know which issue it was because the cover was always the same. Now let's be clear about this. Let's be clear. We're in favor of a general strike, of course. But a one-day general strike is really just a demonstration. An all-out, an indefinite general strike, that's a different matter. An indefinite general strike poses the question of power. It poses the question, who is in command here, you or us? And that's a revolutionary action. But a one-day general strike, or a half-day general strike, or a four-hour general strike does not pose the question of power. It's only a demonstration and a means of applying pressure, which obviously we support that, naturally. But so serious is the crisis now that general strikes can't solve the question. You see that in Greece. And unfortunately, the trade union bureaucrats can use the one-day general strikes in order to tire the workers out as a safety valve, you know. And our former comrades in Madrid will have their wish granted. It will be granted. Yes. They're called many general strikes. Like in Greece. 7 general strikes in Greece so far this year. What difference does it make to the government's policies? No difference whatever. Papandreou is having his arm twisted. As a matter of fact, they're twisting a rather more delicate part of his anatomy, which I will not mention. Tarchidia. They're squeezing a very sensitive part of the man's anatomy. And therefore he says, well, I'm very sorry, my friends, very sorry, comrades, but we have to proceed. No alternative. What can I do? And therefore it's inevitable in Greece, it's inevitable that the strikes and demonstrations will begin to fall off. I think probably that's happening now. It's logical. The workers say, look, how many strikes have we had here? Well, how many demonstrations? Well, what have we succeeded? What has happened? And therefore, the movement will go down. It will go down. Yes. But the most advanced sections of the workers and youth will begin to think about politics. They will come to the conclusion strikes are not enough. This is serious. We need a fundamental change in society, not a strike. We need an all-out general strike, not a one-day strike. And the working class must take power into its hands. It's the only solution. Take over the banks and the factories and the land. That's what we should be putting forward, and we will get an echo. It's an actual fact. The only way out for Greece, for Spain, for Italy, for Venezuela, for all countries, the workers must take power. Capitalism must be overthrown. It is a message which has not yet got a big audience. So we must put forward all kinds of transitional demands. But it will get an increasing audience as the crisis develops. And you must tell the truth to the working class. Trotsky actually explained this in relation to the Spanish Revolution in 1931. Where there was a big strike wave. And Trotsky said the following. Even the stormiest strikes settle nothing fundamental. Never mind about the ones that are defeated, and more strikes are defeated, actually. What is important in a strike? What is important in a strike or a general strike is not whether it gains its demands or not, but it's the experience and the lessons that the workers draw through action and through struggle. That's what's important. And we must always be in the first ranks, of course, of every struggle. But we must patiently explain, starting with the advanced elements, that there is no solution to our problems as long as the capitalist system continues to exist. And we have possibilities everywhere. Latin America, as we've explained many times, at the present time is at the front rank of the world revolution. That is true. Although that can change. We have a situation in Venezuela where after 11 years, you see, and that shows you the difference with the past. It's not the same as when Trotsky was writing in the 20s and 30s. It's an entirely different situation. The correlation of class forces is entirely different. And communists must not just repeat like parrots what Trotsky wrote. You must understand the method of Trotsky and apply that method to the reality that exists now. In the past, in the 1920s and 30s, when there was a deep crisis, there had to be a quick, a pre-revolution situation would not generally last very long. There'd be a quick movement in the direction either of revolution, as in Russia, or of counter-revolution. But the class correlation of forces now is different. And therefore, the situation can last for some time. This unstable equilibrium can last for some time. Take Venezuela. In the past, a movement like Venezuela would be very quickly stamped out by the counter-revolution, very quickly. Either internal counter-revolution or the intervention of American imperialism. Ted used to say before the war, in the 1930s, there'd be crises in different countries in the Caribbean and Central America. And the American newspaper would carry, the next day would carry a headline. The Marines have landed and the situation's under control. They didn't send the Marines to Venezuela. How can they? When they're trapped in Iraq and Afghanistan? I don't see that they can open up a new military front in South America. There you see the limits of the power of American imperialism. They attempted on three occasions to overthrow Chavez. In April 2002, the counter-revolutionaries actually overthrew Chavez. They arrested him and they took power. And for the first time in the history of Latin America, in 48 hours, they were overthrown by a spontaneous movement of the masses. If Chavez had been a genuine Marxist, he could have taken power like that, peacefully, peacefully. As the comrades know, I know Chavez to a certain extent. According to the bourgeois press, I'm his main advisor. Unpaid advisor, I hasten to add. It's news to me. But I know, I personally think that Chavez is a sincere man who would like to carry through the socialist revolution. But he hasn't got the faintest idea how to do it. Incidentally, Serge pointed out to me yesterday, I've not read this document. It's the statutes of the PSUV, the party that Chavez has founded. It's a party on paper of 7 million members. And the statutes of the party put as the aims of the party: the overthrow of capitalism. Since capitalism cannot be reformed, it must be overthrown. The establishment of socialism. And in the ideological section, it says we stand on the ideas of Bolivar and the other leaders of the past. But also, we stand on the ideas of Marx, Engels, Lenin, Trotsky, what's the Italian guy's name? Gramsci. Rosa Luxemburg, and Mao Zedong. You know, but nevertheless, that's quite interesting, isn't it? It's quite interesting. But the Bolivarian Revolution has lasted for 11 years. What is the reality of the position? The Venezuelan bourgeoisie is not strong enough to resort to reaction. Although they will try. We'll see what happens in September. But the working class is paralyzed by the lack of a proper leadership. Because after making all these nice sounds in the programmatic document, they said, yes, socialism, but it must be reduced gradually over a period. You know? Which is a dangerous mistake. The Venezuelan Revolution has now reached the crossroads. It's a decisive stage. After 11 years, there's an enormous tiredness. And disillusionment. Of course, it's a mess. It's neither fist nor foul. It's neither capitalism nor socialism. It's chaos, as a matter of fact. Chaotic situation. Because of the paralyzing influence of the reformist bureaucracy. And it's not clear what's going to happen in the September elections. It's not ruled out that the right wing could win the majority of the National Assembly. It's not excluded, in my view. Or they might get a sizable minority. And then they can sabotage legislation. They can organize counter-revolutionary provocations on the streets. And try to prepare another coup. The question is, what will Chavez do about this? That's an interesting question. I'm not sure what the answer is going to be. But in any case, very important possibilities exist for our work in Venezuela. And I haven't got time to deal with the other countries of Latin America. In Bolivia, it's enough to make you weep. The Bolivian workers could have taken power on at least two occasions in the last period. They staged two general strikes, indefinite general strikes, not one-day efforts, and two insurrections. They overthrew two governments. And the only reason they didn't take power was the lack of a party. Now, I've said that before, haven't I? I've said that before. You think, well, Alan is always saying this. Yes. But it wasn't me that said that. It was the main leader of the COB, the trade unions. What is his name? I can never remember. Eh? Solaris, yes, Solaris. The main leader. I've never seen such a statement. I've never seen such a statement. He says, well, the only reason that we didn't take power is because we did not have a revolutionary party. If I was there, I would say, Comrade Solaris, what is your role in this? Are you just an onlooker? An observer? It's the complete bankruptcy of the so-called left, the so-called Trotskyists in particular. That is the problem. And therefore, in South America, Europe and everywhere else, it is a question of building the subjective factor. It's the only thing that is lacking. I haven't had time to deal with Asia. We have to have a serious discussion on China. There are some very important theoretical questions that must be answered. Some of them were raised by the Brazilian comrades. But we think that these must be discussed in a proper way, not in the form of small amendments. And this discussion is of enormous importance for the whole international. Because China is a key country, of course. But the unfortunate thing about the so-called debate that we had in the past is that it distracted our attention from the main question. Which is the perspectives for the class struggle in China. The establishment of all this industry and so on in China is a very good thing. Because it strengthens the Chinese proletariat, which must be one of the biggest working classes in the world, suffering intolerable exploitation. And you can see the beginnings of that cannot last. Particularly with the new younger workers coming into the factories. The older people, they were peasants coming from the villages, they were prepared to tolerate these conditions for a time. because they said, well, at least we're better off than the terrible poverty in the villages. And anyway, in the future, things will get better. But the young Chinese workers are not prepared. They don't have that mentality. There's been a wave of strikes and suicides in protest against the conditions. In Guangdong, apparently, the authorities have actually legalized the right to strike. That shows you something. You know, they argue, well, China will overtake the United States. It's going up like this. But that's what Jonathan used to say, this kind of argument. Harmonious process. It's not correct. They said the same thing about Japan, by the way. 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But then the Japanese economy entered into crisis, and it's never recovered from that. Chinese capitalism is heading for an almighty crisis. And you can predict an enormous outburst of the class struggle in China, starting with strikes and economic struggles. And the international, of course, has got a duty of reaching China and setting up a base in China. There's the war in Afghanistan, which they cannot win. They will have to withdraw. And again, all that they've achieved in Afghanistan is to destabilize the whole of Central Asia. They've destabilized Pakistan. But of course, we have one of our main, most important sections, the Pakistan section. There's counter-revolutionary elements in Pakistan, of course. But there's also revolutionary elements, a revolutionary ferment, which we're building on. And what occurs in Pakistan, of course, will have a big effect in India, which is in a deep crisis, which is at present reflected in the outburst of guerrilla war. The reappearance of Maoist guerrillas in many states of India. This is a reflection of the bankruptcy of the Indian Communist Parties, which have been in power for decades in places like Bengal, and have completely betrayed the peasants. And therefore, comrades, you see, wherever you look in the world, you see the same things. Extreme instability, extreme turbulence, extreme volatility at all levels. Economic instability, instability on the stock exchanges, social instability, political instability, military instability. These are symptoms of a system which is in a state of terminal decline. There's no real way out of this crisis on the basis of capitalism. The only future that awaits the human race is terrible suffering, violence, poverty, misery, unemployment, as Lenin expressed it. Capitalism is horror without end. And we have the petty bourgeois lamenting this. What a terrible world we live in. It is a terrible world. But these are exactly the same symptoms that you saw with the collapse of the Roman Empire. With the decline of feudalism. They are symptoms of a system which has outlived its historical usefulness. And the only way to put an end to these horrors is through the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism and the seizure of power of the working class, which sooner or later, in one country or another, in one continent or another, is on the agenda for the immediate historical period ahead. And the question before this Congress is not whether the working class is going to fight. That's not the question at all. An explosion of the class struggle is inevitable as night follows day. The question that faces us is a different question. When the working class begins to move, will this international be in a position to take advantage and intervene in a serious way in these events which are being prepared? I believe that the reply to that question will be a resounding yes. We are prepared. We will intervene. And we will win.
I'd like to thank Alan for that excellent introduction to this session on World Perspectives. We now have time for a brief break of 15 minutes. And if those comrades who would like to come into the discussion, please indicate or come and see me. I'll make a note. Alex.